Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, news director at KUNM. On this episode, I interview Margaret Randall, whose archives are at the University of New Mexico. Randall is a poet, writer, translator, photographer, and activist. She lives in Albuquerque, where she's originally from, but she spent a lot of her life in other places, including New York, Mexico City, Cuba, and Nicaragua. She also had short stays in North Vietnam and Peru. Randall edited a bilingual literary magazine for 8 years out of Mexico City and has known some of the great artistic and literary figures of her generation. When she returned to the United States in 1984, the U.S. government ordered her deported. U.S. officials argued she took out Mexican citizenship in 1967, thereby losing her U.S. citizenship. But the government also claimed that the opinions Randall expressed in several of her books were against the good order and happiness of the United States. She waged a years-long battle to finally get her citizenship restored. Randall has received numerous international awards and is the author of over 200 books. Her latest are two books of letters with writers and artists, Letters from the Edge and More Letters from the Edge. They're people Randall calls outriders.
To me, an outrider is someone who is going to do their thing no matter what and refuses to be subdued by society or coerced by society into doing it differently, despite obstacles of different kinds, economic, professional, whatever, they're going to do what they were called to do because they have to. And that, to me, is an outrider. And I just have been fortunate in my life to have known many such people.
Why is it important to listen to outriders?
They set an example, perhaps, of what can be. Very often they're ahead of their time. So they give us great beauty, great knowledge, great excitement. They are usually very curious people. So I think it's to our benefit to listen to them, to look at their work, to read their work.
Do you consider yourself an outrider?
I do.
Tell me more.
Well, you know, I've always sort of done my thing. I grew up here in Albuquerque. I went to the university for a semester, and it was the 50s, a very kind of oppressive time, I think, especially for women. And I dropped out and decided I was going to get my education on my own by traveling the world. And I first went to New York, where I lived for 4 years among the abstract expressionists and beat poets.
So that must have been an exciting time in New York.
Oh, it was extraordinary, yeah. Yes. And of course, I met many people there and then also had my first child there as a single mother in 1960, which was not exactly a common thing to do or usual thing to do at that time. And when he was 10 months old, New York had kind of given me everything that I thought it could. I discovered that you can be a writer anywhere in the world. And so although New York had given me a great deal, it was not an ideal place at that time to raise a child, especially alone, because there were no services, there were no social services, no daycare, you know. And I had to work, of course, and I saw my son very little and wanted to change that. So one day we just got on a Greyhound bus and we headed for Mexico City. I lived in Mexico for 8 years. I married there, a Mexican poet. We had two more children, daughters. And we founded a magazine that was extraordinarily interesting, I think, and useful. It was a bilingual poetry magazine. In those times, there was very little translation, really good translation of Latin American poets who could be read in English in the North, or vice versa. And so, you know, we wanted to remedy that. We published quarterly large issues. Each issue had an average of about 250 pages. They were like books.
Wow.
And we ended up publishing more than 800 writers and artists from 35 countries over those 8 years. But then the student movement happened in 1968 in Mexico, and I was active in that, as many, many people were. Taking part in that and the magazine taking a stand on the side of the students, it ended the magazine's life. I think this was a time when Columbia University in New York was happening.
The protests there taking over the administration building.
Right, mm-hmm. And then what they call the Paris May. But in Mexico, it was a little different. It was somewhat more serious, I think, because Mexico was about to host the 1968 Olympics. And as the movement heated up and students were killed and so forth, Mexico, people began to cancel, right? 10 days before the Olympics were due to open, the movement held a rally in a public square, and the government and paramilitary forces as well shot into that square for 5 hours, killing more than 1,000 people. The official death toll, of course, was 26, but it was pretty horrific. And as a result of that, I had to flee Mexico the following year. So I had 4 young children. The oldest was 8. The youngest was 3 months old. And we had to find our way out of Mexico underground and get to Cuba, where I lived for the next 11 years during a very exciting period in the Cuban Revolution, its second decade, which was a good decade. Cuba has a great many problems now, but at the time it was really thriving despite the blockade, despite the obstacles. And then at the end of 1980, moved on to Nicaragua, where the Sandinistas had just won, and lived there for 4 years before deciding to come back to the States in 1984. And when I came back, I was faced with deportation because of the content of some of my books. So my life has been, I would say, the life of an outrider.
How did you have all the letters that you sent to people?
What happened in terms of retrieving these letters to do these books happened about 2 years ago. My youngest daughter, Anna, lives in the States. She lives in New York. She's the only one of my children who does. And she had an old friend, Mae Jacobs, who wrote her a letter one day and said, I have been hanging out at the Beinecke Library at Yale in my grandfather's archives, and I found 400 letters between your mother and my grandfather. Her grandfather was Walter Lowenfels, who was a wonderful poet, a communist poet, someone who had been prosecuted under the Smith Act, had gone to prison. For being a communist, yes, in the 50s, under McCarthyism and so forth. So apparently Walter had saved not only my letters to him, but copies of his letters to me, which was tremendous good fortune. Reading these letters, I was just fascinated because Walter Lowenfels had sent us a book in 1963, I believe it was, a book to the magazine, which we translated and published bilingually and got original drawings by Siqueiros, the great Mexican muralist, also a communist, to illustrate the book and so forth. So the letters covered that whole period, the translation, the difficulty in producing a book. We prided ourselves that the magazine was never really funded by any kind of institution because we wanted to have the freedom that that gave us. So, you know, those letters were very interesting, and I thought this would make, you know, a really interesting book. And then as I thought about it and I began reading through those letters and selecting what I wanted to use, I thought, you know, I've known some extraordinary people. I wonder if it wouldn't make a more interesting book if I included correspondence with other people. You know the end result of that, which is that I published the first volume, which has 5 correspondence, 5 chapters, each one devoted to a different person. There's an archaeologist, there's an editor, there's a poet, a local painter, Greg Smith, who used to live here in Albuquerque. He now lives in Truth or Consequences. And then, you know, I had too much for that one book. So then there was the second volume, in which I included a Cuban script writer and novelist. And his chapter is extremely interesting because it really sort of lays out the demise of the Cuban Revolution. Mm. And then a curator, an art curator, that's a very interesting chapter. And a social activist, a political activist, Kathy Boudin, who was in prison here in this country for 22 years and became a very close friend.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with the writer, poet, and activist Margaret Randall. She has authored over 200 books, and her archives are housed at UNM. Her most recent books, Letters from the Edge, is correspondence between her and a variety of people she calls outriders, creative people who pursue their work against many odds. They include writers, artists, activists, and even an anthropologist.
Laurette Séjourné was a French-Mexican anthropologist, an archaeologist, whose work was not accepted in Mexico to begin with. And then,
Why was she so controversial?
Well, she was a woman, she was a foreigner, and also her ideas were not the ideas that were held at the time by the establishment, the anthropological establishment in Mexico. Although before she died, fortunately, her work gained great recognition. You know, she was found to be correct in her analysis of the pre-Columbian world. There's such variety in the correspondence from all of these people. I mean, the curator, Robert Schweitzer.
Yeah, he was so interesting.
He was fascinating.
Why did you choose him? I'm curious. He was dyslexic.
I chose him because, well, first of all, we were close friends, and I knew his story. His parents were not formally educated. Neither one of them had gone to the university, but they had very advanced and beautiful ideas about child raising. I consider them outriders. I mean, they were amazing. And so, you know, he tells a story such as, for example, when he was a small child, 5 or 6, he wanted a dollhouse. Well, who would have bought their son a dollhouse? These people did. And he refers to that dollhouse, to rearranging the furniture in it and so forth, as one of the things that led him to his curatorial work, you know. So each one of these people is very interesting in their own way. Jane Norling, she is a painter, quite a well-known muralist in the San Francisco Bay Area. But her story is one that I think many women will relate to, because it's the story of a woman who wants to do her art but also wants to be a mother and has a child with a drug addict and, you know, struggles to separate from this man who's very destructive and find her own way. In some way, every one of these people's story is relevant to today. You know, and it may be because we are in a period right now that's quite similar in some ways to the 50s, to McCarthyism and, you know, with the censorship and so forth. Or maybe these things are always cyclical. Who knows? You know, but so it's a book that references the past. It tells history in a very intimate way in letters. Letters that were not written for posterity or, you know, and they have a certain quality about them. Of course, mail in those years was, you know, it went the slow route. When we were translating Walter Lowenfeld's book, it would take 2 or 3 months for a letter to get from Mays Landing, New Jersey to Mexico City, and the same amount of time to get back. We couldn't even afford airmail, you know. So, you know, there's a quality, there's a very tactile, hands-on, face-to-face quality about all of this correspondence.
I was astounded, when you were translating Lowenfeld's poetry into Spanish. You had to do this with mail that was that slow.
Yeah, and you know, we had a deadline, so we had to keep going, and sometimes we would ask questions, and then the answers would come 3 months later. Yeah, there were different times, but we managed.
You know, you mentioned Lowenfeld was arrested. I mean, that was a particularly chilling. Federal agents break into his house. At one point, they're pointing a gun at his typewriter.
Yes. He had a great sense of humor. You know, he and his wife were lovely people, and they contradicted every kind of U.S. American ignorant image that I had of what a communist would be. I had never met a communist before. For one thing, they...
Even though you were accused of being one.
Yeah, but I never really was a member of a communist party, and especially at that time, I had no idea. He had a great sense of humor. He was very imaginative, kind of magical in his thinking. that passage where he describes the federal agents coming to his little shack in the woods that was his writing studio. I think he says something like, if they had been prosecuting me for my sonnets, I might have understood, but...
What are the risks that outriders have faced? We just talked about one of those.
You know, it depends on what moment in your life you are. But if you're a young parent, for instance, there's always a risk that you can't really support your children in the way that you would like. Losing a job, you know, not being published in magazines or by publishers that pay a lot. I mean, there's lots of risks, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that one of the things about outriders is they don't really think of the risks. You know, the risks sort of don't matter. They're compelled to do what they feel they must do, so they mm-hmm. do.
Can you talk about your relationship with Kathy? Is it Boudin?
Boudin.
Boudin. She was part of the Weather Underground and was convicted of murder in the 1981 Brinks robbery. After she got out, she published an essay expressing remorse for that crime. Why did you see her as an outlier?
My relationship with Kathy was very interesting. We had a mutual friend, Ruth Hubbard, who was a biologist at Harvard, very close friend of Kathy's and a very close friend of mine. And I taught for 9 years at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Kathy was incarcerated in Katona at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, which is only about 2.5 hours from Trinity College. Ruth lived in Boston, and one day she said, you know, I think you and Kathy would have a lot to talk about. So she took me to the prison, and I met Kathy. And we instantly hit it off. We were from the same generation. We had faced the same injustices. We were both very affected by the U.S.-American war in Vietnam, by U.S. government policy in Central America and so forth. But we had taken different routes to try to remedy that situation. I had done so mainly through my writing and through living in places like Cuba and Nicaragua, where I, you know, was involved in contributing to try to create a different kind of society. And she had gone the route of armed struggle. We didn't really agree on methods, but we had a deep agreement in terms of our feelings about the role of the United States government throughout the world, its exploitive role, its aggressive role. I think one of the most moving parts of the chapter with, based on my correspondence with Kathy, is her struggle over the 22 years she was incarcerated to come to terms with the fact that 3 law enforcement officers had died in the action that she was arrested for. She did not pull the trigger. She was not even armed. She drove one of the getaway cars, but she nevertheless was involved in this action, which cost 3 lives. And she really needed to come to terms with that in order to live with herself, I suppose. And it was very complicated, her coming to terms with that, but it wasn't really an essay that she wrote. It was a long letter that she wrote to me, but also sent to other people in her life. So that process is extremely interesting. And then Kathy did a lot of amazing things during those years she was in prison. She got a master's degree. She created an AIDS outreach program. She created a program for women, for mothers with small children, mothers who were incarcerated and separated from their children. So, you know, she contributed a great deal, even in those very constrained circumstances. And when she got out, she got her doctorate at Columbia and then founded a center which continues today long after her death. She's been gone for about 3 years. And it's a center that is 75% staffed with ex-prisoners, deals with prison conditions, rehabilitation, all that kind of thing.
She was, of course, a controversial figure. She and her husband had a young son when they did the bank heist. How do you think grappling with those competing imperatives helped shape her life as an outrider?
Oh, I think it affected her deeply. I mean, she was actually preparing to come above ground because of having this small child. He wasn't even a year old. And she was convinced by other people to be involved in just one more action. And of course, that was the fatal action. Mm. And so her son was raised by other people. The first 22 years of his life, she only saw him in prison. And of course, her husband was in prison. And so he had to visit both of his parents in prison. Despite that, he became a Rhodes Scholar and the Attorney General for San Francisco.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
So he's a very Chesapeakean. He's a very interesting figure in his own right.
You're a mother as well, as you mentioned. How did that shape your journey as an artist and a poet and your political work and your relationship to the people you feature in these books?
You know, I was crazy enough or outrider enough, perhaps, to always believe I could have it all. I could be a mother, which I've always wanted to be. I could be a grandmother, a great-grandmother, which I am today. I could be a poet, a writer, a photographer, a social activist. I just never thought that I had to choose. I'm not quite sure why I was like that, but that's the way I grew up. And my parents, I must say, were quite supportive of all of my outrider activities. Somehow, the mother is always expected to be the emotional mainstay, and in many cases, economic also, of a child's life. So I always had to support my children. I always had to work at something else to do that. Yeah, it was not always easy. And a couple of my daughters, especially, were very resentful. They used to say when they were younger, you wanted to make a better world for all the world's children, but you abandoned us. I don't really accept that.
Wow, that's hard.
but you know, I understand how they felt. And fortunately for all of us, we've resolved our relationships in quite a beautiful way. So we're all very close today. But yeah, that's not easy. You know, the father is always sort of expected to have other interests and go out and, you know, in the world and still be a parent. Many more demands are put on women, I think, even today.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. On this episode, I speak with Margaret Randall. Her latest books focus on letters between her and people she's met over the course of her life. She calls outriders, rebel minds who have avoided being silenced or controlled. Randall is a prolific author, poet, photographer, and activist who grew up in Albuquerque, but she lived in Mexico, Cuba, Nicaragua, and other places before she returned to the U.S. in 1984 and encountered unexpected challenges. You were living, as you said, in Mexico in the 1960s and decided to take citizenship, which meant relinquishing your U.S. citizenship. Why did you want to do that?
Yeah, I did not realize that it meant relinquishing my U.S. citizenship. And in fact, I didn't want that to happen. I took out Mexican citizenship. I was married to a Mexican. I expected that marriage to last. It was very much easier to get a job as a citizen than it would have been as a non-citizen. And it was also very easy. Being married to a Mexican, it was not at all difficult to acquire Mexican citizenship. And then after doing so, I went to the U.S. Embassy and I told them that I had acquired Mexican citizenship, but that I hoped that I had also kept my U.S. citizenship. And they surprised me by saying, no, you haven't. You have lost your U.S. citizenship by virtue of having taken out citizenship in another country. In point of fact, they were incorrect. There had been a change in the law which had not quite filtered down to consular level at that point. But of course, today you can be a Mexican citizen or any citizen and retain your U.S. citizenship. But they took my citizenship away. And so I lived for many years as a Mexican. When I came to the States, I would have to get a visa like anyone else. And when I decided to come home for good in 1984, I had to first get a visa, which was not difficult. But then I had to apply for residency, a green card, and then citizenship, just like any foreigner who comes into this country. And that is where the Immigration Service at that point, based on the content of 7 of my books, they decided that they were going to deny me residency, which they did. And then I had a choice. You know, I could leave the country. I was ordered to leave the country within 28 days, or I could stay and fight. And I, being an outrider, decided to stay and fight. And I had tremendous support. The Center for Constitutional Rights in New York supported me. They provided lawyers. They set up more than 25 defense committees across the country. And we did a lot of outreach explaining McCarran Walter, the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1952, which most people didn't know existed. I mean, you could be denied residency for all kinds of reasons. If you had a communicable disease, if you were gay, if you had not only membership in a communist or socialist or anarchist party, but even if you just had what they called meaningful association with someone in one of those parties. It was fine if you were a fascist or belonged to a fascist party. That was not part of the law. So we felt that it was important to explain McCarran Walter. And we did that for the 5 years of my case. And I kept losing at each instance until I finally won.
Does that mean that was overturned?
It does not mean it was overturned, but that particular clause, which was called the ideological exclusion clause, was overturned as a result of my case and as a result of several other cases that were going on at the same time. And of course, today, you know, things have changed in terms of the way immigration is used in this country. It doesn't matter if you're a communist anymore, but if you're Arabic or Islamic or, you know, those are the boogeymen today. So some of the details have changed, but immigration is still being used in this country punitively.
It would have seemed a few years ago that something like that happening to you would be unthinkable. I'm not sure I could say that sitting here today.
Oh, I'm
September
very sure
2025.
I wouldn't say that. No, no.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because my case took place under Reagan. The five judges who eventually gave me a positive outcome, all five of them had been appointed by Republican presidents, Reagan and Bush Sr., and yet I won. Mm. Absolutely impossible to think that that could happen today.
Some of the revolutionary movements during the years you document have not fared well. I mean, you mentioned Cuba. One of the outriders you talked to sort of documents the dissolution of the revolution in some ways. And I'm thinking of Nicaragua, or the original leader of the Sandinistas, Daniel Ortega, is in power. Incredibly repressive.
Oh, he's a dictator. He and his wife were both really terrible dictators. Yeah, every single honest Sandinista from those years that I shared in Nicaragua is either in prison, in exile, or dead. And yes, in general, I think it's a period of right-wing populism throughout the world. We live in dangerous times.
Well, given that, are you able to find hope or joy?
I certainly find joy. I find joy in my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, my partner. I find joy in my work, my friends. Hope, I'm not so sure about. I would like to be hopeful. I do have hope in the younger generation, in spite of the fact that one of the things that I think the right wing has done so successfully is erasing or distorting our history. In spite of that, many young people have exciting ideas for change. Locally, you see many initiatives throughout the world that are hopeful. I guess at heart, I'm an optimist, even though my optimism is being strained these days.
Well, Margaret Randall, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you for having me, Megan.
That was Margaret Randall speaking about her latest books, Letters from the Edge and More Letters from the Edge, Outrider Conversations, both published by Village Books. You can find a link to this interview and all the episodes at KUNM.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. And thanks for listening to University Showcase and supporting KUNM.